From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, filling in for Terry Gross. Yesterday, President Bush threatened to send jets into Iraq to back up the UN inspections of Iraq's weapons. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with international lawyer David Sheffer about Iraq's non-compliance with ceasefire resolutions and what the world community is allowed to do about it. He's been following Iraq's progress with the resolutions since the end of the Gulf War. Also, how the recovery movement is turning us into a nation of victims. It's the subject of an article by writer David Reif and appears in the October issue of Harper's. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews The Fisher King, the new film by director Terry Gilliam. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. After a day of groping for ways to stop the fighting in Yugoslavia, European community leaders backed away from proposals to immediately send an armed peacekeeping force to the area. NPR's John Idsty reports from London.
European community foreign ministers meeting in the Netherlands today could only agree to study how a military force might support EC peacekeeping efforts in Yugoslavia. The study was a compromise aimed at bridging disagreement over proposals to dispatch a peacekeeping force. A French and German plan put forward this morning called on the EC to ask the United Nations Security Council to approve the sending of troops from Western European nations to Yugoslavia. But the British, who would have likely been called on to provide large numbers of soldiers, opposed the idea. Earlier today, the EC-sponsored Yugoslav peace talks broke off. Croatian and Slovenian officials said they would not resume the talks until the violence ended. But the Serbian foreign minister said the talks would resume next week. I'm John Idsty in London.
The United Nations Security Council has approved a plan that will allow Iraq to sell oil for the first time since the invasion of Kuwait. The six-month arrangement would allow Iraq to sell up to $1.6 billion worth of oil, with the proceeds to be controlled by the United Nations. Profits from the sale would be used to buy food, medicine, and other humanitarian supplies for the Iraqi people. Some of the money could be used to pay war reparations. Iraq would have no control over how the money is spent, and it's not clear whether Baghdad will accept that condition. The United States and Kuwait signed an agreement today allowing the Pentagon to stockpile supplies in the Desert Kingdom and to coordinate joint exercises between the two countries' militaries. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The agreement was signed this afternoon at the Pentagon by Defense Secretary Dick Cheney and the Kuwaiti Defense Minister. The pact is the first agreement between the U.S. and a Gulf state since the end of the war with Iraq. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said it's not a mutual defense treaty, but a defense cooperation agreement.
It permits the United States and Kuwait to cooperate together in improving the defenses of Kuwait and enhancing the security in the region.
The Pentagon says the two countries' militaries will decide just what types of equipment will be stockpiled in Kuwait. Analysts say the equipment itself is not as important as the signal the agreement sends that the U.S. is prepared to intervene again if Kuwait's security is threatened. The U.S. is conducting talks with other nations in the region, hoping to reach similar agreements. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 6 points to close at 3,024.37. Advances edged declines in active trading of 210 million shares. This is NPR News. For the second day in a row, Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin canceled his engagements and stayed home with what was described as a slight illness. The acting chairman of the Russian legislature told delegates that Yeltsin could not make a planned speech at today's opening session because his doctors have ordered him to rest. Yeltsin is 60, and the news of his ailment raised concern yesterday when it was described as a heart problem. Today, there was speculation that the Russian president might be feigning illness to avoid a debate with Russian lawmakers who are angry that he's transferred some of their powers to the executive branch. For the second time in the past year and a half, Portland, Oregon greeted President Bush with angry demonstrations. Police used mace and clubs to quell the violence. Tess Vigeland of member station KOPB reports.
Police arrested more than 20 demonstrators outside the Oregon Convention Center in downtown Portland during the president's visit. Bush was in town for a campaign breakfast to support Oregon Senator Bob Packwood in his bid for re-election. Most of the arrests happened after the president left the center. About 500 people gathered outside to protest the administration's stand on issues ranging from the Middle East to gay rights to Croatian independence. Noting his concern for the ailing timber industry, Bush had praise for Packwood.
Hasn't forgotten the human equation, the fact that people need jobs and must not be thrown out of work by extreme environmental positions is known to him. And I don't believe we need extreme to solve the problem.
Bush's next scheduled stop on his West Coast tour is Los Angeles. For National Public Radio, I'm Tess Vigeland in Portland, Oregon.
The U.S. balance of trade with other countries shifted dramatically for the worse in July. The Commerce Department reported today that the trade deficit grew by 56% from the month before. The trade deficit is the difference between what the U.S. imports and what it sells to foreign nations. I'm Corey Flintoff, National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. President Bush announced yesterday that he's going to send warplanes into Iraq if Saddam Hussein continues to defy the UN Security Council resolutions drawn up after the Persian Gulf War. Though Bush said he had no immediate plans for military action against Iraq, the planes will accompany UN helicopter inspections of Iraqi military facilities. This new involvement in the Gulf has brought into question how far a nation can go to try to enforce resolutions passed by the UN Security Council. My guest is David Sheffer, an international lawyer and a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Sheffer has just written a chapter in a new book about international law published by the Council on Foreign Relations. His chapter is called Use of Force After the Cold War, Panama, Iraq, and the New World Order. I asked him to review for us the UN resolutions that established the ceasefire after the Persian Gulf War.
Well, the ceasefire arrangements are in something called Resolution 687, which was adopted on April 3rd, and it's the most comprehensive, lengthy resolution ever adopted by the Security Council. It has more than 30 paragraphs to it, and it establishes many things. One, it sets up a means by which to determine the border between Kuwait and Iraq. It sets up a peacekeeping team to patrol the demilitarized zone between Kuwait and Iraq. And then it sets up a very extensive, unprecedented, intrusive inspection regime in Iraq to ferret out all possible information about Iraq's nuclear capabilities, its chemical weapons capabilities, and its biological weapons capabilities. It sets up a procedure whereby UN inspectors can enter Iraq, and they have the right to enter Iraq, regardless of what Iraq thinks about that, to inspect sites that they suspect might have any of these capabilities on those sites. And it also sets up a means for destroying these weapons if they exist. And then it finally sets up a means for an ongoing inspection and monitoring of Iraq indefinitely with respect to these weapons of mass destruction.
Before we get to the violations, tell us what Iraq has complied with.
Well, to some extent, it has complied with the inspection regime. It has not been in total violation of it. The problems that have arisen in the last few months are parts of the inspection regime, incidents of denial of access to certain facilities, but it's also true that Iraq has permitted and facilitated inspection to many facilities, so there has been a partial compliance with the inspection regime. Iraq is also participating in the determination of the border between Iraq and Kuwait. It is facilitating many of the other important provisions of 687, which include the return of seized Kuwaiti property to Kuwait. There's been a lot of return of that property, including gold bars, which were taken by the Iraqi army, and other cultural property, which has been taken. So to that extent, there has been some compliance with Iraq.
What tangible evidence is there that Iraq still has nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons?
Oh, well, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that is being uncovered by the UN inspectors. The big surprise was that the UN inspectors found that Iraq's nuclear weapons development program was far more extensive and highly developed and imminent in terms of actually producing a weapon than anyone had really, you know, any of the seasoned experts in these matters had really predicted. A lot of it was covertly being undertaken by the Iraqi government, and much of that information has now been uncovered by the UN inspectors, which only leads them to ask more questions and to seek to inspect more suspect sites. And that's where some of the problems are cropping up.
Iraq has said that they would allow UN inspectors to visit weapons facilities, but they must go in Iraqi helicopters with Iraqi pilots. Does this meet the requirements of the ceasefire resolution?
Well, it certainly does not meet the requirements of the UN Security Council. The ceasefire resolution, while it speaks generally of the right to inspect, has been succeeded by, or followed, I should say, by Security Council Resolution 707 of just last month in August. And the Security Council could not have been more clear in its stipulation in that resolution that the right of overflight, the right of inspection through rotary and fixed wing aircraft is unqualified, that Iraq has no right to interfere whatsoever with the UN's inspection of these sites by air, and that, you know, there's nothing in that resolution that supports the Iraqi position. So we have a very specific resolution on the books now, quite recently, that gives the United Nations inspectors full authority to use their own aircraft for these inspections.
Do the Iraqi violations, though, give the United States and President Bush the right to send U.S. warplanes to Iraq to provide air support and escort service for United Nations helicopters who are there searching for Iraqi weapons?
I think you can find that authority in the resolutions for the escort service, because that is not, in and of itself, a belligerent act on the part of the United States. It's simply an effort to provide some protection to UN inspectors who are going about the duties which they are authorized to do by the Security Council. It's somewhat analogous to the deployment of UN guards to help protect the humanitarian aid workers in Iraq last spring, in April and May. There was a deployment of UN guards to provide them with some protection as they provided humanitarian aid to the Kurds. This is the similar kind of concept, and since the Secretary General does not have an air force at his disposal, the Security Council members do. And so I would argue that this does fall within the context of the resolutions.
By allowing the United States then to provide this kind of escort service, does it also implicitly allow them the right to fire their weapons?
Well, certainly in self-defense, yes, but not for the purpose of using the escort service as a pretext to take out various targets in Iraq. I mean, that would be a very different situation.
What can inspectors learn by actually and physically visiting facilities? What specific information can they get about nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare technology?
Well, theoretically, and in many respects quite practically in recent months, they can obtain all of the information that they're in fact seeking. The production capability for these particular weapons, the kinds of chemicals which have been obtained by the Iraqis to facilitate the production, for example, of chemical weapons. They can also obtain information, which they are obtaining, on who has been supplying these materials to Iraq in the past. Which companies in Germany and the United States and Japan and elsewhere and France have actually been engaged in the trade of these particular materials with Iraq. And they also, it's a lot of bean counting, to be quite frank. In other words, how many canisters of chemical agent are actually present at which site and at what state of condition are they in to actually be used for weapons purposes. So all of that is a very detailed bean counting exercise, and what they have learned in this experience is that the initial reports by Iraq with re- regard to the numbers of chemicals, agents, the number of weapons, the kind of nuclear capabilities that exist at these various plants, has been grossly underreported by the Iraqi government. So it's been a step-by-step process of pressuring the Iraqis to come clean on the exact extent of these particular materials. Another important issue is ballistic missiles, and that is one of the most serious ones. 62 Scud missiles have been located and now destroyed by the UN teams, which is a fairly significant development in and of itself. But there is very serious speculation that the Iraqis hold at least 200 more Scud missiles, which they have not reported openly to the UN teams. So part of the reason for this continued need to engage in inspections on Iraqi territory and to be more intrusive with those inspections is to try to locate what the Iraqis themselves are not reporting to us.
What are the ways that Iraq has been able to hide its weapons, whether it's chemical, biological, or nuclear, or even their Scud missiles, from inspectors?
Well, from what we've learned, they've actually buried some of these weapons underground, and they've been when the UN inspectors have discovered this, they've actually had the Iraqis dig them up again. Another way they have hid them, and this was the incident that got so much news last July, was to simply truck them away out of sight. And this occurred at one of the nuclear sites in Iraq in July, and when UN inspectors tried to actually get a closer look of the trucks which were carting these cyclotrons away, they were shot at, of course, over their heads, but nonetheless, shots were fired. So that's another way. As for the Scud missiles, I don't think we really know yet how they have hid, if they have at all, these alleged additional 200 Scud missiles. Iraq is a very large country, and in fact, one of the lead UN inspectors the other day said, in response to how long are you going to have to keep at this, he responded, well, Iraq is a very, very large country, which only implies that there are a lot of places yet to inspect, especially in western Iraq, where so many of the Scud missiles launchers were located during the war. There are lots of places out there where Scud missiles can be hidden.
If the UN inspection team gets access to all of Iraq and actually can comb the country for their weapon systems, what assurances are there that Iraq won't develop this technology in the future?
Well, that's built into the ceasefire resolution 687. There is going to be an ongoing, indefinite verification and monitoring inspection regime in Iraq. I mean, UN people are going to be there for the indefinite future. So there is a procedure established in the ceasefire resolution for continued inspection of their potential to develop weapons of mass destruction. There will presumably have to be more details worked out on that as this process continues and we have, you know, determination that we've destroyed everything that we know exists, and how do we now conduct inspections in Iraq? Will they be as intrusive? But the point is the Security Council has made that decision.
What weapons will Iraq have to defend itself? And is the result or the desired effect of all this to leave it defenseless?
Well, no, that's not the objective. But the objective is to ensure that it has no weapons of mass destruction to defend itself with, that it will only have conventional weapons, those that have survived the Gulf War, and furthermore, that there is a continued prohibition on all nations to trade any arms whatsoever, to export any arms whatsoever to Iraq. Now, at some point in time, the Security Council can lift that boycott on arms trade to Iraq, but it can lift it with conditions. It can lift it by, you know, saying that a certain number of conventional weapons can be exported to Iraq over a certain period of time, but it can reach those decisions in the future. For the time being, Iraq has to make do with whatever is left after the Gulf War, and the Security Council is quite determined not to allow any more arms exports to that country until its peaceful intentions are confirmed.
David Sheffer is my guest. He's an international lawyer and senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. We're discussing the current Iraqi violations of the ceasefire agreements and the U.S. response, as announced yesterday by President Bush, that he would send U.S. warplanes to Iraq to escort U.N. helicopters who are looking for Iraqi weapons installations. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Sheffer. He's an international lawyer and senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace. A few weeks ago, a number of Iraqis actually invaded an island off the coast of Kuwait. Does this represent a significant violation of the ceasefire agreements?
Oh, yes. In fact, the Security Council has described not only the violations with respect to the inspection regime, but many of these other violations as material breaches. Those are the words they use, material breaches of the ceasefire resolution. And there's no question whatsoever that any attempt to occupy Kuwaiti territory is a material breach of both the immediate ceasefire resolution, when the firing actually stopped, and the ceasefire resolution of April 3rd, which was the more comprehensive ceasefire resolution. We have many incidents now of Iraqi soldiers, sometimes not in their own uniforms, but rather in civilian clothes, penetrating Kuwaiti territory. Many of these interventions are to retrieve Iraqi munitions, which have been left behind, whether it be in the demilitarized zone or on this particular island, which they occupied for a short period of time. So there's no question those are material breaches of the Security Council resolutions.
One of the questions raised at the end of the war was whether the coalition forces went far enough in, and whether they actually should have gone and removed Saddam Hussein from power. Do these violations, you think, give the coalition forces a legal reason to get rid of Saddam Hussein?
No, I don't think they provide the legal authority yet. I know several individuals are arguing to take the campaign all the way to Baghdad now, if we do use force again. But no, a decision was made not to eliminate Saddam Hussein as the leader of Iraq, unless he happened to find himself in a particular command and control center during the war and would have lost his life as a consequence of that. But in order, we just have not come that far in international law or in the practice of the Security Council to authorize the overthrow or elimination of what some may consider to be an illegitimate or lawless government. We may reach that stage someday. But even in this case of the Iraqi aggression against Kuwait, the object was to redress that violation of international law. In none of the resolutions is it stipulated that the government of Iraq must change or that it must be eliminated. I think the practical point to make here is that you can eliminate Saddam Hussein through other means that the consequence of which is the collapse of his government, rather than to explicitly and specifically say that Saddam Hussein and his government is the target of some kind of enforcement action.
You have an essay in a book called Right versus Might, International Law and the Use of Force. And you say that international law was a winner during the Gulf conflict. And I realize it's not exactly that cut and dried. But as these post-war conditions and problems drag on, do you see that victory, if indeed there was a victory in international law, becoming cloudier?
Well, no, not necessarily. I mean, yes, you could always argue it's cloudy and murky, but I think we need to understand that we are entering an era of international law enforcement, and it's going to be a rocky, you know, road ahead of us. But the point is, we have a lot on the books now in international law. We've gone through a tremendous four decades of codifying principles of international law. And yet we don't have all that much experience with actually enforcing it. And Iraq is the first major test case. And I would argue that since the end of the Gulf War, we still have a pretty good track record of enforcing these principles of international law and of at times almost pushing the outer envelope of international law for the sake of enforcing very general principles that before have been more theoretical than practical, such as general principles on the fundamental human rights of peoples. That came into play with the plight of the Kurds back in April and May, and the interest that nations developed in intervening for humanitarian purposes in northern Iraq. Well, that all folds into this evolving notion that we're moving more and more toward a capability to enforce international law. The real challenge will be whether or not that enforcement is carried out unilaterally by states such as the United States, or whether we move increasingly toward a collective capability for taking those enforcement actions.
Do you think, in talking about the current situation, do you think Iraq will back down?
Yes, I would anticipate that they're going to permit these UN flights to take place over their territory. It's all part of a pattern where they are trying to squeeze what they can out of the United Nations to preserve their own sovereignty in these matters. And yet in this case, the issue is not significant enough, I would think, for Saddam to jeopardize the possibility of more airstrikes against Iraq. He can seize other opportunities to assert Iraqi sovereignty. This overflight issue really should be viewed by Saddam as a minor issue. And in fact, his ambassador to the UN yesterday, Alan Bari, admitted that look, this is a tempest in an empty teapot. And I think we saw there a real indication that they're going to not inhibit these inspection flights.
David Sheffer, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Okay, thank you.
David Sheffer is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, where he specializes in international security law. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moskowain with Fresh Air. Bookstores now have whole shelves filled with titles like Healing the Child Within, The Codependent Reality, and Rediscovering Your Discarded Self. In the new issue of Harper's Magazine, writer David Reif says these books and authors like John Bradshaw are fueling a dangerous trend, an obsession with self, and an avoidance of problems like poverty, pollution, and war. Coming up, a talk with David Reif. Also, film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews The Fisher King by director Terry Gilliam. It stars Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In New York City, the UN Security Council has approved a resolution that will allow Iraq to sell oil for the first time since its invasion of Kuwait. But this resolution imposes tough condition on the sale. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The resolution was approved 13-1, with Yemen abstaining and Cuba opposed. The measure lays out details of a plan already approved in principle by the Council last month. Under the plan, Iraq can sell $1.6 billion worth of oil over the next 6 months. The revenues will go into a UN escrow account. Part of the money will go to pay for some of the tasks associated with the Gulf War ceasefire, such as the destruction of Iraq's weapons. The rest, almost $1 billion worth, will be used to purchase food, medicine, and other goods for the Iraqi people. This resolution came in response to several UN reports warning of an impending famine in Iraq, which has been unable to buy food for more than a year. Iraqi officials have complained bitterly about the conditions imposed on the sale, and it is not yet clear whether they will cooperate with the plan. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In Beirut, Lebanon, a group claiming to hold Western hostages says that no one will be set free until Israel releases 20 more Arab prisoners. In a statement released along with a photograph of Joseph Sosipio, the Revolutionary Justice Organization says that it is freezing any future hostage releases until the picture of the Israeli stand is clear and the UN moves. In Moscow, Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin canceled his appointments for the second day in a row after leaving work yesterday with an apparent heart ailment. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Moscow.
Reports in Moscow last night suggested that Yeltsin had suffered a heart attack and had to be taken to a hospital for observation. But the Russian president's spokesman, Pavel Vashanov, said today that Yeltsin had only complained of chest pains and had gone home to rest. In Russian, heart attack can have a different meaning than in English, ranging from minor chest pains to a major seizure, a fact that contributed to last night's confusion. Vashanov said that Yeltsin's condition today was satisfactory and said the president would go ahead with the trip tomorrow to Nagorno-Karabakh to mediate in the dispute between ethnic Armenians and Azeris. Yeltsin today canceled a meeting with U.S. Treasury Secretary Nicholas Brady and the planned speech to the Russian parliament. The Russian television news program Vesti tonight suggested that Yeltsin's illness may have been a political one, a deliberate attempt to avoid confrontation with Russian deputies who believe Yeltsin is concentrating too much power in the presidency. I'm Michael Sullivan in Moscow.
NATO plans to cut its armed forces in Central Europe by 50% by 1995. The Secretary General of NATO says a conventional forces in Europe treaty signed last year should be ratified as quickly as possible. This is National Public Radio News. The International Red Cross has asked the United States for information and reports that hundreds of Iraqi troops may have been buried alive by U.S. tanks during the Persian Gulf War. The Iraqi Foreign Ministry asked the Red Cross to look into the matter, charging that Washington had broken Geneva Conventions. Secretary of State James Baker was in Amman, Jordan today discussing a Middle Eastern peace conference with Jordanian officials. Baker has already made stops in Israel, Egypt, and Syria. Jan Ziff filed this report for the BBC.
As he goes from country to country, Mr. Baker is being very careful to underline the issues in the letters of assurance tailored to each one that are of prime importance and do so publicly. In Syria, he said the United States was prepared to give Damascus assurances that Washington considers the Golan Heights to be Israeli-occupied territory and that Israeli law and jurisdiction over it was not recognized. In Amman, the policy was the same, but the thrust a little different. Here, Mr. Baker again stressed that a comprehensive settlement was being sought on the basis of United Nations Security Council resolutions 242 and 338. Mr. Baker said the letters of assurance reaffirmed certain understandings, explanations, and commitments that had been reached over the course of months of discussion. He said that now was the best opportunity that had presented itself in a very long time.
Jan Ziff reporting for the BBC. Critics of the Bush administration's education plan say that they disregard a fundamental problem, the differences between rich and poor schools. At a Washington News conference, some of those opposed to the president's educational ideas said that there are lawsuits in a dozen states addressing what they consider a key issue, wide gaps in spending between poor and richer school districts. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved higher. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It's hard to know exactly when the self-help movement began, but the movement today seems to be running at a fever pitch. Tune in during a public TV fund drive, and you're likely to find John Bradshaw, one of the leaders of the recovery movement, mesmerizing an audience of adults with talk of dysfunctional families and wounded inner children. Just check out some of the titles at your local bookstore: Healing the Child Within, Rediscovering Your Discarded Self, Learning to Love Yourself, Finding Your Self-Worth. And recovery groups are not just for alcoholics and drug addicts anymore. If you work too much, eat too much, shop too much, exercise too much, have sex too much, there's a support group for you. This is a trend that worries writer David Reif. In an article in the October issue of Harper's Magazine, he cautions against the message of these recovery groups, that everyone is a victim.
The original self-help groups were about very specific kinds of difficulty. I mean, all the recovery movement, I think they themselves would admit this, is based on AA, on Alcoholics Anonymous. And they never imagined, I don't think, the people who founded AA, that they were starting a movement which could be applied almost to anything. People seem in this movement to make absolutely no distinction between, say, the need to recover from having been abused as a child to simply working too hard.
There are a number of proponents of this most recent recovery movement. I think John Bradshaw is considered, if not the leading, probably the most popular proponent. What would you say his essential message is?
Well, I think Bradshaw's principal message is that we have all been abused as children. He starts from the idea that child abuse is not a phenomenon of a small or relatively small group of people in this country, but a phenomenon which is sort of culture-wide, if you like. I think he does this parenthetically by a kind of sleight of hand where he describes abuse as not simply being a sexual assault or a physical battery, but any kind of unwelcome psychological pressure. But leaving that to one side, his line is, we've all been abused, we're all in recovery, and therefore the only job, if you like, that a person can do in order to reestablish their mental and moral equilibrium is to treat themselves. And through he and another leading recovery therapist, a woman called Linda Capaccioni, have come up with the term inner child. Your wounded inner child, the child who is not properly nurtured by your parents, needs to be healed before you can get on with your life. And I think that's the basis of the Bradshaw message.
Do you believe that there is some truth to that message?
Well, I think that it's certainly true that many more people were abused as children than the medical establishment or for that matter, probably the sociological establishment wanted to admit. What troubles me about recovery, and the reason I think it's such a fraudulent way of looking at the world, such a mistaken way of looking at the world, is that they rob words of all their meaning. They don't satisfy themselves with saying more kids have been abused than society likes to admit. They go on to say that practically any kind of inadequate parenting is a form of child abuse. And I think what they're really doing is making an entirely ridiculous argument with human nature. Because, of course, the fact of the matter is that no parent is going to do a perfect job. But that doesn't make all these parents child abusers, as the Bradshaw people would like to claim.
When you heard that phrase, inner child, what did it mean to you, if anything?
Well, when I first heard it, I thought it was preposterous. I thought most of us have spent our adult lives trying to run away from our inner child. We're all too childish as it is, it seems to me.
Did it have any meaning sort of beyond that, even to think about a wounded part of yourself?
But you see, my quarrel with the recovery movement and with people like Bradshaw is not based on any disagreement that there are wounded parts of oneself. Of course they are. There are. It's Bradshaw and the recovery movement's absolute unwillingness to view life in tragic terms that probably got me upset enough to write this piece. I think the mere fact of death, something from which we don't recover, it seems to me, should be enough to make one very suspicious of this kind of optimistic blather, the refusal to accept tragedy, the refusal to accept life's limitations. It seemed to me when I first heard about the recovery movement, and still seems to me to be its worst and most important flaw.
Writer David Reif is my guest, and he has an article in the October edition of Harper's called Victims All, Recovery, Codependency, and the Art of Blaming Somebody Else. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer David Reif is my guest, and his article in the latest edition of Harper's is about the proliferation of self-help books and self-help gurus, as he describes them, people using the addiction and recovery model and language to try to explain human existence, I guess. I wonder, too, what you thought during the war in the Persian Gulf when people tried to explain, and these would be psychohistorians, tried to explain the actions of Saddam Hussein by investigating his past. I know it's been done with Hitler. Apparently he was abused as a child, and this is used maybe not to justify, but certainly to explain the Holocaust itself.
Well, this all comes from mostly comes from the work of a rather well-known Swiss psychiatrist, psychoanalyst, Alice Miller. I think it's nonsense, I must say, frankly. What I think this provides is an excuse for turning away from politics and also turning away from judgment. I mean, if we're all victims, if, to use the most extreme example, even Hitler is a victim, and Bradshaw is absolutely categorical on this. In his books, he says over and over again that Nazism can be explained because Hitler was abused, which seems to me, first of all, in the face of things, rather doubtful, since the kind of brutal upbringing Hitler had was also the upbringing of people who led very decent lives. So that seems to be a very insufficient explanation to start out with. But more importantly, it's a flight from any kind of belief in politics so that everything becomes a personal story. It's not that, for example, the interests of an Iraqi dictator might be a set of interests. And that one can condemn those interests. It's that somehow we would all be the same if only we'd all sort of own up to our rotten childhoods. And I think that's a kind of flight into the personal that frankly also fits in with a lot of very callous political attitudes that have, in my opinion anyway, taken over during the period that Ronald Reagan and George Bush have been in the White House, a kind of belief that that only the personal matters, that you owe no obligations to the larger society or the larger culture. The interesting thing to me about the recovery movement is here are all these people saying, in effect, I'll deal with the outside world when I've healed my wounded inner child. And what that boils down to in practical terms is I won't deal with the larger world. I'll just go on doing this therapeutic exploration of myself.
Well, what interests me is how this language of addiction and recovery slowly but surely makes its way into everyday conversation. The inner child. We see, we hear, we read references to the inner child more and more. And as you say, codependency, it's another, it's kind of a buzzword that everyone thinks they know. What do you think makes this language so compelling?
Well, I think this is a deeply therapeutic culture, a deeply narcissistic culture. People have in some sense made their own psychological development their lifelong vocation. I mean, a more civilized society would think that the idea was to try to grow up, that is, to have a more mature relationship to the world. But instead, what the Bradshaw people want to suggest is that you never have to take any responsibility. You never have to grow up. You are this wonder child, another phrase that Bradshaw uses, although it's obviously gotten less into the language. And the self-indulgence of it can be appalling. In Berkeley, California, which has a very large homeless population, many of the merchants now give sell these 25-cent tickets, a kind of scrip. And the rationale behind this is that people passing don't want to give these homeless people money which they might spend on drink or drugs. And so this scrip is redeemable in stores for food. And a number of people who were interviewed at the time that this movement began said that they felt that they did not want to be codependent with the homeless people's drug or alcohol addiction. Now, I just think that's a grotesque inversion, whatever you may feel about the homeless person. For a person who has a job and is in reasonably good shape psychologically, to worry about their codependency with some person who sleeps in the street and has a life expectancy of 45 seems to me to put it upside down.
I think an argument could be said, and perhaps people involved in the anonymous movements or the codependency movements could argue this better than I, but by looking at the psychodynamics and by trying to explain all this, it's not an excuse. It's not necessarily to let people off the hook. It might be used that way, but the intent is to try to explain and understand oneself.
Yeah, but that's undoubtedly the case, and there's no doubt that through, for example, AA, a lot of people have stopped drinking, and through NA, Narcotics Anonymous, a lot of people have gotten off heroin and coke. But the point is, this movement is now so big and so broad that it includes and invites in, more importantly, all kinds of people who really have no business feeling sorry for themselves in this way. I think it is a kind of, to me, lack of respect for the world to say that your own psychic melodramas almost by definition have more weight than the claims of the world, of your family. And it's very important to remember that one of the things John Bradshaw, for example, asked about relations with the older generation, said, we didn't come into the world to take care of mommy and daddy. Well, most cultures have believed rather the opposite, that we owe the old certain kinds of respect, and we owe just as we owe the young certain kinds of respect. And it seems to me a very funny idea that you're sort of only in it for yourself. I mean, it's an astonishing world view.
I think it's fair to say that John Bradshaw would not be the figure he is today without PBS. And he was discovered as a good fundraiser program. What are your thoughts about this marriage between Bradshaw and PBS?
Well, I wish the marriage could be dissolved, but I gather that in any PBS station eager to have a fundraiser, the surest way to get a bigger share of, of viewers is by running those Bradshaw and the Family programs.
What's wrong with that, though?
Well, what's wrong with that is just simply that that Bradshaw's message, I think, is actually quite dangerous to people. And certainly, I think, very dangerous to the culture, because I think it simply produces self-absorption, complacency, and a kind of pitiless disregard for others. You see, it strikes me as being so interesting that the recovery movement has really gotten into gear at precisely the moment when this culture has turned its back on institutionally, on the poor, on people who can't cope, on people genuinely in distress.
In writing this article, did you interview John Bradshaw? Did you read all the books about codependency? Did you attend, I guess you can't attend a lot of meetings, but how close did you get to this whole movement?
You know, I didn't see anybody. I watched all the tapes that I could lay my hands on and listened to a lot of audio tapes by other people besides Bradshaw, and I read every book I could lay my hands on. I have, I think, one of the more complete recovery and codependency libraries in the country. I'm not quite sure what I'm going to do with it now that I've written the piece, but I own it and I've read it.
Are you better for it?
No, I'm more enraged. And more despairing, because if that is what millions of people believe, then we're in even more trouble than a skeptic and a pessimist like me believed before. Because this stuff, I think in the end, for all its claims to be based on compassion, is really very cruel. Cruel to the society and cruel to people who can't afford to go to seminars and worry about their own psychic health.
Did you not interview for a specific reason? I mean, did you not want to talk to these people?
Well, I've read a lot of interviews with Bradshaw and indeed quote from several in the piece, and I don't have any particular sense that I'm a better interviewer than the people who've gone to see him. I must say, what I did do is I talked to a number of people who are devotees of this movement, and when this piece is on the stands, who I expect will be very angry with me indeed.
David Reif is the author of an article on the recovery movement in the October issue of Harper's Magazine. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. What do you have for us, Robert?
Well, Marty, we'll be hearing some news from Washington, including developments at the confirmation hearings of Robert Gates to be director of Central Intelligence. Today, indications that Mr. Gates had seen a memo about the Iran-Contra affair a little bit sooner than he had earlier said he knew anything about it. We'll also have our affirmative action series continuing with a report on affirmative action and federal workers, report by Brenda Wilson, and a talk with Soviet expert Dmitry Symes, just back from the Soviet Union, on what he saw there and what course he sees the Russian Revolution taking.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. Terry Gilliam began his career as the animator for Monty Python's Flying Circus and then directed such madcap fantasies as Time Bandits, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, and the cult favorite, Brazil. His new film, The Fisher King, stars Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams. Critic Owen Gleiberman says it's a real change of pace.
There are three things you can safely say about Terry Gilliam. He has a gift for creating pop imagery that's spectacular and comically charged. He thinks nothing in the world is funnier than squalor, and he couldn't tell a straight story if you put a gun to his head. Now, though, this naughty boy surrealist has made a somewhat conventional Hollywood movie. It's got big-name stars, a contemporary New York setting, and a wacky yet sentimental storyline. Perhaps it's no surprise that with Gilliam at the helm, The Fisher King is a bit of a mess. Jeff Bridges stars as Jack Lucas, a smugly cynical talk radio host whose on-the-air rant inspires a deranged nerd to go on a killing rampage. Jack, who's stricken with guilt, quits the radio business and hits the bottle. The Fisher King is the story of his redemption, his return to humanity. One drunken night, Jack wanders into a dark corner of Manhattan and is saved from a vicious mugging by Perry, a homeless man played by Robin Williams. Perry is a former professor of medieval history who had a psychotic breakdown when his wife died. Now, he imagines himself a knight searching for the Holy Grail. Jack knows that Perry is crazy, but he starts hanging out with him anyway. He helps set up a date between Perry and a hopeless klutz named Lydia, played by Amanda Plummer. For a while, the Fisher King turns into a lunar version of Marty, the story of two lovable losers falling for each other under the urban sky. The act of bringing these two together helps reawaken Jack's spirit. It also rekindles his romance with a tough but nurturing video store owner, nicely played by Mercedes Rule.
I really think she went for him.
Oh, I know.
She went for him.
I can't believe it. I can't believe I did it.
Amo vincit omnia.
What?
It's Latin. It means love conquers all. I don't mean us. I don't mean us. I mean everybody else.
You think it'll work out?
Who knows? Who knows? You know, two people could be at a party together, sitting right across from each other and never find each other. Another two people could be on opposite sides of the world. Nothing could keep them apart.
The Fisher King is often corny and conventional, but nothing in the movie quite fits together. Why does the dour, sleazeball Jack come back to see Perry in the first place? Gilliam never establishes a convincing bond between the two men. And how can we believe in Perry anyway, when Robin Williams' manic shtick keeps undercutting the movie's reality? The Fisher King does have some funny and charming moments, especially when Williams and the wonderfully gawky Amanda Plummer go on their nerd's night out. As a director, though, Gilliam can't seem to find a tone. He lumbers from dark satirical scenes of Jack's radio show to fantasy visions of a faceless red knight to earnest domestic psychodrama. Much of the time, he's content to have Williams and Bridges just trudging around Manhattan. There's an air of thrift shop desperation to Gilliam's approach. When one of Perry's homeless buddies dons a dress and high heels and launches into a high-decibel cabaret number, it's literally such a showstopper that you realize the show is going to have trouble getting started again. If the Fisher King proves anything, it's that Terry Gilliam may be too idiosyncratic to go Hollywood, even if that's what he thinks he wants.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our engineers this week are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Veblaitis. Today's show is directed by Chris Spurgeon and Roberta Sharrock. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the 1992 presidential campaign should be held. Political analyst John Ellis has written a proposal about how the campaign should be conducted in the media. It includes a series of televised Sunday debates between the candidates to counteract the dreaded soundbite. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.